So Vesak, the month of Vesak, the full moon of Vesak, we celebrate the life of the Buddha, specifically the birth, enlightenment, and parinibbana. And as Lumpur Samedu often would say, you and I experience birth, we'll experience death. Let's hope we get the in-between bit too, the enlightenment. And it kind of classically, it defines a spiritual life. Historically, you have the historical Buddha, but classically, but just as a metaphor for human existence, there is birth and death. We all experience that. But there is a possibility. There is a spiritual possibility which we all can touch if we pick up this teaching and follow it. So I'll read from these. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So this is the Buddha, the story of an awakened life by David Curtian. And he writes a lot of stories for kids. So I thought something light, not too heavy. And stories are for imagination, and imagination is for inspiration. So let your imagination float with the story. Our Buddha was born in the foothills of the Himalayas, where the fertile fields of the Ganges Valley rise gradually into hills and purple mountains, whose peaks carry the eternal snows of myth and legend. His father, King Suddhodana, was these terms, there's the Sanskrit version of the places and people in the life of the Buddha, and there are the Pali versions. This book is in the Sanskrit, so I shall read the Sanskrit version for those of you familiar with the Pali. His father, King Suddhodana, was the ruler of the Shakya state, a small country whose capital city was Kapilavastu. King Suddhodana belonged to the clan lineage of the Gotamas. His wife, Mahamaya, was the daughter of a powerful Shakya noble. She was better known as Maya, which meant illusion, a name that fitted her perfectly, for it was said of her that she was as beautiful as a girl in a dream. She was of noble character, pious and wise, and abhorred immodest behavior, cruelty, and unkindness. Her only regret in life was being childless. She yearned and prayed that a son would be given unto her. Much of her time was spent visiting temples, where she prayed and made offerings. Her husband was patient, reminding her of the prophecy of a wandering rishi. "Have you forgotten a look on his face?" he said to his wife. "When gazing up at our palace, he declared, 'Here a child shall be born who will be a ruler among men, truly a king of kings.'" Looking back at her husband, Maya smiled, afraid to speak because tears had already begun to well up in her eyes. "We will attend the festival of the full moon of midsummer, which begins on the morrow," the king declared. The next day, dressed in royal robes, they mounted their prize elephant and led the parade through the town. They were followed by sacred cows that had garlands of flowers strewn over their horns. The men sang in chorus, while horns blew and confetti rained on the adoring crowd, while dancing maidens adorned in spangled skirts and ankle bells wove among the gathering throng. The festivities continued for 1 week. On the final day, Maya arose from her bed, bathed herself in scented water, and went into the city, where she distributed gold pieces to the poor as alms. She returned to her rooms exhausted, and without undressing lay down on her bed and fell instantly into a deep sleep of dreams. When she awoke, her husband was at her side rubbing his eyes, having wakened at the same moment. Maya looked longingly at her husband before speaking. "The four kings of divine guidance just carried me to the purified waters of a mountain lake, where I was bathed in the heavenly waters of paradise, purifying me of every stain. And then instantly I was clothed in a flowing gold garment and carried to a veranda atop a silver mountain, where appeared a lordly six-tusked elephant, also silver-colored. The child shall be born where the flower star shines in the east," her husband exclaimed. "Please wait. Maya beseeched him. Can it be so? Oh, yes, the elephant was carrying a pink lotus in his trunk. It was then it trumpeted, racing around me three times before striking me on my right side. And then with that, it melted into vapor, disappearing in the air. But what is strange is that I did not feel its presence in my side, but in my womb, that it had entered in some mysterious way. They both fell silent and embraced each other, feeling gratitude and joy that was beyond the power of words. With great pomp and ceremony, the king summoned his Brahmins to court, along with soothsayers, priests, and wise men. After listening intently to Maya's dream story, the wise men spoke with near unanimity, in separate but linked sentences, acknowledging the presence of a miracle that was clear equally to each of them. This beginning can have but two endings, said one, but not necessarily, said the next. There will be great joy, for he will be a fitting descendant and worthy. The king interjected, why two endings? If he chooses a worldly life and remains in the palace, he will become a universal monarch, the greatest we've seen. But if he renounces his position of power and wealth, he will become a wanderer, a holy man, and one day a completely enlightened Buddha, who will provide the world with the elixir of deathlessness. Yes, for his response to suffering will be the deciding factor. The king was pleased and gave out rich gifts to his Brahmins and arranged a feast for all his people. Maya returned to her chambers in great joy and wonder. Invisible gods moved at her side, and she was never again alone. In the days ahead, she had but to rest and ponder her fate and that of her son. The months passed for her in quietude and serenity. When the time of her son's arrival grew near, she said to Suddhodana, it is time for me to return to my parental home in Devadaha, as is the custom with the women of my family. The king, of course, agreed and made great preparations for her departure. For the long day's journey, Maya was outfitted with a palanquin, along with servants and courtiers. When they had journeyed as far as Lumbini Garden, they paused for rest. Maya descended from her carriage and began to walk inside the park. The spring flowers were in bloom, and birds were calling from the trees. She stopped to listen to the cry of a distant peacock while standing in the green shade of an Ashoka tree. When she looked up, the overhanging branches swooned over her protectively, and in that instant she gave birth to her son. He appeared before her in a transparent sphere of liquid light as a completed being, but in miniature, and then in the next instant he was wrapped in a saffron robe at her breast, and she was cooing in his ear, the sweet perfume of her breath on his forehead. It was evening when they arrived at the palace gate, their pathway lit by something more than the moon's fullness, for the light of heaven shone with such brilliance that even the dark, shadowy earth was lit, as if night were day and the moon an evening sun. In a remote cave deep in the Himalayas, a renowned rishi penetrated the mystery of the holy birth, and guided by the light that shone from above, was directed to the gate of the king. The holy man, by name Asita, was ushered into the great hall to be met by his lord, who was himself deeply honored by the rishi's visit. But it was the rishi who had come to make obeisance. I have traveled here to witness the arrival of the Holy One, he said. The king was pleased and commanded the prince to be brought into the room. Asita gazed upon the golden countenance of the holy prince, and bowing, placed the child's feet upon his forehead. I see now with plain sight what I knew I would find here. The 32 major and 80 minor marks of a great being are present on his body. For such a one there can be but two destinies, that of a universal monarch or of an enlightened Buddha. He said, hesitating and turning his face from the king before continuing, who will live a life of homelessness while traveling the spiritual path. Two possibilities, the king questioned aloud before sinking into his chair. These were the words of my Brahmins, but I did not hear the first time these words were spoken what this could mean. I could lose my son to the world, and if this were to happen, what then will the world mean to me? The king's reverie was interrupted suddenly by the rishi's sobs. But why do you cry? The king asked, thinking not of the rishi but of himself. I cry in happiness for the glory that this birth portends and I cry in sorrow that I will not be here to see it unfold. But you are enlightened being, the king exclaimed. I have not yet attained to the ultimate realization. Asita sighed. The world will soon be bathed in a great light, but I will not be here to see its radiance or to receive its gifts. The Rishi mumbled something under his breath as he was escorted from the palace that was heard only by one of the king's attendants. The queen mother will pass away in 7 days. The king will be sorely tested. Already the preparations have begun for her grand reception as the mother head of the coming Buddha. The king's sorrow will now equal his glory. Poor king, poor king. For every gain there must be a loss, from every loss a great gain. The prophetic words of the Rishi soon became the king's experience. For the 7 days that Maya lived, a dark cloud shadowed the palace walls as if to prepare its inhabitants, who would have to bring into balance the immeasurable gain of a divinely born prince with the death of their treasured queen. The king was bereft. With the loss of his wife, his radiant happiness brought about by his son's birth was now shattered. He could not eat or sleep, his mind torn in two by the violent collision of his great gain, followed most immediately by the unbearable loss of his beloved wife. He had named his son Siddhartha, he who has attained, but with that he seemed to break his filial connection, retreating into silence in order to nurture his grief in private. Maya's sister, Mahaprajapati, took upon herself the role of living mother to the baby prince. Time passed, and when the king's period of mourning had been completed and his sanity restored, he and Mahaprajapati married. So we have the birth. And then there's a few years of adolescence, which sounded pretty good, actually. And then we have the great renunciation. So the Buddha, at age 29, gives up the household life and travels from teacher to teacher and then does 6 years of ascetic practices. So this part will begin after he's been with Alara Kalama, his first teacher, and continue from there. Once again, Siddhartha was alone, but joined to his path that now carried him in an easterly direction. There was joy in his heart and sadness, for he was leaving the place of his first liberation, and he was leaving behind his first teacher. While on his way, he heard of another teacher, not far distant, by the name of Udaka. When he presented himself to the master, he explained what he had received from his former teacher, and also what he was searching for. Udaka had achieved a new level of meditation that he called neither perception nor non-perception. Siddhartha set himself to learn what this meant, working with all his might and with the will he had developed under his first teacher's tutelage. When Siddhartha had achieved the freedom inherent in the practice, Udaka, like Kalama, assured his pupil that he had no more to teach him, and he too asked Siddhartha to remain with him and take leadership over his community of monks. Siddhartha refused, explaining that although he was able to stand beyond the space occupied by form and formlessness, he knew that the witness that could watch was not free, but must remain and enter again the cycle of suffering in his next rebirth. Therefore Siddhartha told Udaka, "I have not yet achieved enlightenment. My goal is yet before me." As Siddhartha traveled about the country, he began to observe the ascetics who had committed themselves to self-denial by way of a strict discipline that each of them had worked out for himself. Some thought they could achieve enlightenment through the limiting of food intake, bordering on starvation. Others immersed themselves in cold streams and rivers during the winter months, or sat naked before blazing fires, enduring flames that blistered their flesh. Some took up their abode in regions where corpses had been abandoned, where they also took a code of silence. And still others tried to live on grasses alone, behaving, for better or worse, like the sacred cows they admired. After crossing the Naranjana River, Siddhartha ascended Mount Gaya and came to a forested region near the village of Sena, the Uruvela district. He settled himself there and began to devise his own austerities in pursuit of enlightenment. Siddhartha's past experiences has shown him that he could not achieve his goal by studying with acknowledged masters. for they had taken him as far as they could. He would have to master himself and evolve a teaching based solely on his own experience and understanding. In the quiet village of Sena, along the banks of the river Niranjana, in the shade of its towering trees, he found a place propitious and inviting where he could begin the next phase of his work. As he began to fathom the purposes of the ascetic life, Siddhartha saw too that this way would be different from that of other ascetics, for it was clear that each of those he had observed sought deliverance for themselves alone, some to avoid unfavorable karma, others to avoid rebirth on the earthly plane. It was their detachment from life that troubled Siddhartha, and he asked himself how the ascetics differed from those involved in ceremonial rites and in the doing of various good work for the purpose of emancipation through mental discipline. If a seeker were to be of service to anyone, Siddhartha thought, wouldn't he first need to perfect himself through self-knowledge? If life was calamitous, didn't this calamity arise from the defective nature of each being? And wasn't it from there that the journey must begin? What I seek for mankind, Siddhartha reasoned, I seek for myself. But really, there is no difference. I am mankind, and mankind is me. I must therefore purify myself. Moving through the wilds alone, Siddhartha came face to face with his fears. Unfamiliar noises terrified him. The sounds of animals unknown to him, the snapping of a branch, the far-off rumble of thunder, all these made him tremble and want to run away. He began visiting forest shrines at night, which filled him with terror and dread. But by standing firm and facing each fear as it arose in his mind, he began slowly to conquer this weakness in himself. By doing so, he saw that fear was perhaps his and man's greatest enemy, for it undermined hope and faith, as well as a healthy belief in oneself. The greatest fear, he realized, was that of one's death. Once he had conquered this in himself, he felt he could endure anything in pursuit of his aim. Having recognized that the discursive mind is the enemy of the spirit, he devised an exercise for working on this problem. He began by clenching his teeth and pressing his tongue against the roof of his mouth, believing that in this way he could suppress his thoughts until his mind crumbled. He was attempting to use his mind to control his mind, but apart from strengthening his will, he saw that he was powerless to control or even subdue his thoughts. But little by little, a certain mental clarity began to appear. Next, he attempted to arrive at a state in his meditations where his breathing had virtually stopped, but the result was a loud roaring in his ears and severe head pains. Although his mind was temporarily stilled by this practice, he could not endure the pain in his body. He began to be more successful with his experiments when he realized that each was a product of his questioning spirit and questioning mind, and in each case he arrived at a clarity that was unique to his nature, that was practical, realistic, and down to earth. He knew that in truth, action was above truth in thought, and therefore each experience provided him with the data he needed to fulfill his quest. He became more and more thorough in his experiments for all of these reasons. News of Gotama, as he was now known, began to spread, for it was said that he had equaled his master's conscious attainments, yet he had refused to share in the training of their adepts, instead striking on his own to lead an ascetic life, determined to reach enlightenment. The monks and ascetics came to observe him from a distance, and it was they who gave him the name Gotama, after his clan, for he was now no longer Siddhartha, but one of them, and yet not one of them, for they sensed that he would one day achieve nirvana. Among the seekers who came out of their own curiosity and need was the Brahmin Kundanya, who had attended the prince's name-giving ceremony, predicting at the time that Siddhartha would one day achieve Buddhahood. Kundanya was now a homeless mendicant as well, and with his fellow seekers called a band of five that included Vashpa, Mahanama, Asaji, and Badrika, had journeyed to Uruvela to become Gotama's disciples, imitating his austerities in the hope of achieving enlightenment for themselves. I am now practicing submission of the flesh, Gotama explained to his followers. When I began this practice some time ago, I decided I would eat in a day only what I could hold in the hollow of my hand, a few peas, beans, lentils, or rice, or at most a single crab apple. Gotama had grown so frail from his practice that his followers began to tend to his immediate needs, while also following his lead. 6 years had passed since Gotama had left his home to become a wandering monk. But the enlightenment he sought seemed as far away, if not further away, than when he had first set foot on the path. By now, because of the mortifications to his flesh, he began to resemble an old man with withered skin and falling hair who had to be helped when he walked. His spinal column began to resemble a string of beads, his buttocks two camel hooves, his head a shrunken gourd, while his eyes, having faded into their sockets, began to resemble two distant stars in a reflecting well. One day, while struggling to reach the river's edge to bathe himself, he stumbled from exhaustion, unable to rise from the ground, until he grasped an overhanging branch that had mercifully bent down to help him to his feet. Gotama struggled as best he could until he reached the base of a banyan tree above the river's bank, and sat down in great pain and bewilderment. At that moment he remembered the peaceful bliss he had experienced in his youth, sitting under the rose apple tree, safely exploring with his mind that was at rest in the bosom of nature. Reflecting on that moment, he realized that the spirit cannot be tyrannized into freedom through the mortification of the flesh. The spirit is free, it has always been free. It is this other, this self, that is not free, that have not yet set free, but have placed into a deeper bondage instead. The body is my vehicle, but how can it help carry me to my goal if it has become a broken vessel? His revelation was answered by the smile of eternal grace, for at that very moment there appeared in the presence of Gotama a young woman named Sujata, who had vowed to the tree spirit he was sitting under that upon the birth of her longed-for child she would make noble offerings to the tree every year. She bowed before Gotama and offered him the rice and milk porridge she had prepared, believing he was the keeper of the tree's spirit. Sitting on the opposite bank, the band of five were appalled to see their teacher eating substantial food. "Look," they said to each other, "he is eating householders' food and has given up the struggle for enlightenment." Without another word, they got to their feet and began to wander off in the direction of Benares. Gotama, nursed from the porridge, fell into a deep reverie and did not even notice their departure. The next phase of his quest had now begun to take hold in his mind. He realized that in order to continue his journey, he would need to bring his body into balance with his mind, thereby restoring his spirit. He began eating again in a normal way, taking his begging bowl into Uruvela, where he was once again in the presence of everyday people. Gradually his health began to return, and with it his powers of reason. He thought, "There is a pattern to our lives that we cannot see but must live, and in living fulfill the destiny of its design." But he could not yet see that he had to arrive at the border of death and to the depths of despair before he would be able to reach the heights he aspired to, for one could not experience one without the other. He had become the equal of death and of life. His six-year ordeal in the wilderness had been completed, and now at the age of 35, with all his bridges burned, as naked as a newborn child, and even more alone, he was about to enter his final transcendence. With the strength renewed and calm in spirit, Gotama made his ritual climb up Mount Pragbodhi to the cave in which he took his meditations. One day, the quaking of the earth rendered the cave too dangerous for sitting, and as Gotama began descending the mountain, a heavenly voice whispered, "There is a diamond seat beneath a Bodhi tree southwest of here across the Niranjana River." With no more instruction than that, he set his foot upon the path that would lead him to the mentioned tree, not knowing that his life would soon be changed forever. Standing before the Bodhi tree, Gotama peered through its tangle of branches into its cavernous shade, and although he had forgotten about the diamond seat mentioned in the heavenly instructions, he saw that he was meant to find his place here and seek the enlightenment that he had long sought for and that now seemed to have been claimed for him from above. Gotama was startled to hear the singing voice of a boy carrying a basket of sweet grass on his back. "What are you called?" Gotama asked the boy. "Svastika," the boy answered. Good fortune, Gautama exclaimed, for that was the meaning of the boy's name. May I have a bundle of your sweet grass to make a seat for myself? The boy happily obliged, and resuming his singing, continued on his way. Gautama moved through the tangled vines of the Bodhi tree, and facing east, he took his customary lotus position, sitting on the mat made from the grass he had been given. Closing his eyes, he vowed that he would not again rise from this spot, even at the cost of death, until he had attained supreme and absolute wisdom. As expected, Gautama's resolve materialized the diaphanous form of Mara, who projected his demons, creating through the power of illusion projections of power through the acts of war, the pleasures of the senses through seductive dancing girls, and pure reason through the achievements and allure of the intellect. But Gautama, because of his long, arduous struggle with his own weaknesses, had, in overcoming his fears, defeated his own demons until he had arrived at the brink of complete self-realization. He made quick work of Mara, who knew now that his tenure had been permanently broken by the coming Buddha. And this is from the texts. There, the enlightenment is described in various ways, and this one is described in the first watch of the night. The Buddha sees how beings, his own past lives, and he sees how beings are reborn, and then he realizes the deathless. So this is from the Majjhima Nikaya. When my concentrated mind was thus purified, bright, unblemished, and rid of imperfection, when it had become malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I inclined my mind to the knowledge of recollection of past lives. I recollected my manifold past lives, that is to say, one birth, two, three, four, five births, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 births, 100 births, 1,000 births, 100,000 births, many ages of world contraction, many ages of world expansion, many ages of world contraction and expansion. I was there so named, of such a race, with such an appearance, such food, such experiences of pleasure and pain, such a life term. And passing away thence, I reappeared elsewhere, and there too I was so named, of such a race, with such an appearance, such experience of pleasure and pain, such a life term. Passing away thence, I reappeared here. Thus, with details and particulars, I recollected my manifold past life. When my concentrated mind was thus purified, I directed and inclined my mind to the knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings. With a divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw beings pass away and reappear, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, happy and unhappy in their destinations. I understood how beings pass on according to their actions. These worthy beings who were ill-conducted in body, speech, and mind, revilers of noble ones, wrong in their views, giving effect to wrong views in their actions on the dissolution of the body after death, have reappeared in states of privation. But these worthy beings who were well-conducted in body, speech, and mind, not revilers of noble ones, right in their views, giving effect to right view in their actions on the dissolution of the body after death, have reappeared in a happy destination, even in a heavenly world. Thus, with a divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw beings pass away and reappear, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, happy and unhappy in their destinations. I understood how beings pass on according to their actions. So the Buddha now sees deep time in the karmic sense. He sees this endless cycle of birth and death, birth and death, birth and death, birth and death, birth and death. And you look at the numbers, how he says hundreds of thousands of world contraction. It's like deep, deep time. And this has just been going on since forever. So his aspiration is the deathless. It's not about getting a good rebirth, right? He's not searching to do this again. He doesn't want to recycle his being. He wants to find a way out. So his psychic powers are profound. He's a very profound being, obviously, to be able to hold that in what's unimaginable, what he could see. But so that I think that reference is very important in understanding Buddhism, that Buddhism isn't about gaining better psychological states, just being more psychologically well-adjusted. It's deeper than that. Psychological adjustment, well-adjustment, is for the sake for enlightenment. You know, it's not, that's not its end point, that's not its goal. So, when my concentrated mind was thus purified, I inclined my mind to the knowledge of exhaustion of taints. I had direct knowledge, as it actually is, that this is suffering, that this is the origin of suffering, that this is the cessation of suffering, and that this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. I had direct knowledge, as it actually is, that these are taints, that this is the origin of taints, that this is the cessation of taints, and that this is the way leading to the cessation of taints. So what he sees is the Four Noble Truths. Knowing thus, and seeing thus, my heart was liberated from the taint of sensual desire, from the taint of being, and from the taint of ignorance. When liberated, there came the knowledge, it is liberated. I had direct knowledge. Birth is exhausted. The holy life has been lived out. What was to be done, there is no more of this to come. This was the third true knowledge attained by me in the third watch of the night. Ignorance was banished, and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished, and light arose, as happens in one who is diligent, ardent, and self-controlled. But I allowed no such pleasant feeling as arose in me to gain power over my mind. And this is interesting. You'll find in the text this kind of line where, you know, the Buddha does some of the most fantastic kind of stuff, psychic powers and past life stuff. And then he says, but I allowed no such pleasant feeling as arose in me to gain power over my mind. A very simple kind of statement. And so the Buddha's, you think of enlightenment, you're going to woohoo or something. And yet the Buddha's just always this state. He's just seeing the way things are. And Buddhism is about wisdom. It's about dispelling darkness. It's not about getting stuff. And this, the capacity of the mind to really see the way things are, that focus of mind to really observe, is what we're trying to do. And the depth of that, it's kind of unimaginable for us when we read this. But that's why we're here, because it was such a profound thing. So let's pick up the story with the end at the end. So the Buddha now has consumed some food that is food. So he has food poisoning now. This is in the last year of his life. And the food he's eaten, unfortunately, is, I mean, the speculation, and it might have been mushrooms or something like that. He is now food poisoned, okay? And he's in the last days of his life. This is where we turn to... They had not gone far before Buddha stopped. And so this is about... He's 80 years old. He's got a few days left in his life. And he's got food poisoning. So he's 80 years old. He's very weak. And so you think, well, a Buddha, you know, he gets out of it. It, somehow, if you're a Buddha, you're not going to have old age, sickness, and death. No, you don't get out of it. So the Buddha goes through it too. They had not gone far before Buddha stopped and asked Ananda to prepare a seat for him beneath a tree. I am thirsty, Ananda. Go fetch me some water from the stream we just crossed. Lord, the farmers in ox carts that were on the road just behind us have churned up the water. It will not be fit to drink until the mud has settled. Go, Ananda, I need to drink now. But Lord, the water is undrinkable. Now, Ananda. Ananda reluctantly rose to his feet and trudged to the stream. Kneeling on the bank above the mud-stirred water, he lowered the Buddha's bowl. To his amazement, the water entering his bowl was clear and fresh and undisturbed. The Buddha slept fitfully that night, and in the morning they set out again for Kusinara, traveling in slow stages. When they reached Naranja River, they were met by a commercial caravan led by a Malian named Pukusa, who had once been a disciple of Alarakalama, but who, after leaving the order, had become a rich merchant. Gotama, remembering his youthful discipleship under Alarakalama, was pleasantly disposed to receive the Malian merchant, who came forward to meet the Buddha bearing two shiny robes of gold cloth. You will honor me by accepting these, Lord, Pukusa begged. fearing his offering would be refused, Buddha acquiesced, understanding Pukwas's need to make a connection once again with the path he had left so many years before. When the merchant departed and they were alone again, Gotama watched as Anand addressed himself and then helped Gotama on with his golden robe. "How interesting," Gotama said. "As the giving of these robes put Pukwas in touch with his own abandoned past, the donning of these robes reminds me of our origins as Sakyan nobles." Ananda nodded in agreement, but when he stepped back to admire the Buddha, he was amazed to see that the golden robe that had glowed in his hands just moments before had now lost all of its luster, for it was the Buddha that shone now, while the garment by comparison became a pale, lackluster yellow. "This is a marvel, Lord. Can you feel what I see? This is a transformation that can happen but twice in a Buddha's life, causing this sheen of bright emanating gold to appear upon my countenance, making the skin clear and free of its aging components. Once, on the eve of his enlightenment, and then on the eve of his final nirvana. In the first instance, it is the result of the abandonment of his former life. In the second instance, it is the release of whatever clinging to life still remains. Now we will remove these robes and bathe in the river, and after I have taken my rest, we will go to the Sala Grove at Kusinara, named after the twin Sala trees that grow there." Sleeping with his head to the north, between the twin Sala trees, Gotama had laid down to rest in the lion's sleeping pose, with one foot resting upon the other, in a state of mindful awareness. While asleep, in full consciousness, he became aware that the powder of sandalwood and petals of Mandarava flowers were falling from the heavens. Those in attendance watched in veneration as the powder spread evenly over the Buddha's body, and as it fell, the singing of angelic voices could be heard above the clouds. Gotama opened his eyes to the blossoming flowers of the twin Sala trees, and all marveled, as this was not their season for flowering. "The leaves honor you, Lord," those closest to him said, bowing in reverence. "This is not the highest honor," Gotama said, turning to Ananda. "The highest honor for the Blessed One comes from the monks who walk in the Dhamma. Therefore, pledge yourselves anew, once again, before I depart, that you will walk in the Dhamma, that you will venerate and respect and honor the Dhamma." All answered, "In this you have our pledge." Ananda was too overwhelmed to answer with the others and removed himself from the Buddha's sight. Leaning against a tree, he began to weep and commiserate with himself. "My Lord, who is about to attain final nirvana, is thinking only of my welfare, and after all this time, I have not yet attained enlightenment." Sensing Ananda's absence, the recumbent Buddha asked where he had gone. "Lord, Ananda was overtaken by your compassion, and feeling remorse at his own inability to attain enlightenment, he has removed himself from your presence." Knowing what was in Ananda's heart, the Buddha said, "Go to him and say, your teacher wishes to see his friend." Ananda composed himself and returned to his master's side. "Do not lament my passing, Ananda. Have I not told you again and again that in this life we must face the departure of loved ones? For all that rises falls, and all that appears disappears. But there is no death, there is only separation, and for this we must be prepared. No Buddha has ever had a more faithful attendant than you, who has served me with loving kindness and without reserve for all these years. And more than this, you have instructed and guided those who walk the Dhamma. You have made great merit, Ananda. It will not be long before you attain arahatship." Gotama knew that all who heard the words addressed to Ananda would receive guidance for their own inner work, understanding that the greatest merit is earned by service, but that the privilege of service must first be earned. Ananda was made free to let go and stand on his own, but the thought of his master's departure was more than he could bear. "Lord," he pleaded, "do not attain final nirvana in this jungle village. Let us go on to Benares, where you will be venerated by Brahmins, nobles, and warriors." It is beneath you to speak this way, Ananda. Go now into Kusinara and announce to the Malians that this is the last watch and that they should present themselves. That is not to be said of them in the time to come that the Buddha died in their presence and they were not in attendance. At Ananda's beckoning, the people came streaming out of the villages in great numbers, weeping and tearing at their hair, crying, "The final nirvana of the Buddha has come. Soon the eye of the Great One will vanish from the world." Ananda was amazed at their grief and understood, as he had not quite understood before, the powerful influence of his master over the life of that place and indeed of the whole world as he knew it. Ananda could see that he must not let each Malian pass before the Buddha, for if he had, the night would pass and the lines would still be forming. He therefore quickly gathered the representatives from the various clans and instructed them to address the Buddha, naming their family, retinue, and friends with the words, "We salute with honor the Blessed One, with our head at the Blessed One's feet." Just as the organized procedure was about to begin, a wanderer by the name of Subhadda pushed his way through the crowd. "Perhaps it is more than mere chance," he thought, "that I find myself here in Kusinara at the last watch before the Buddha attains final nirvana. All these years I have wandered, wishing to believe, but unable to overcome my doubts. Now is my chance to challenge and be challenged by putting myself before the Great One." He approached Ananda. "Master, may I see the Buddha?" When Ananda shook his head dismissively, Subhadda asked again, "I have been riddled by doubts all my life. I have never come this far before. How can I turn back now that I have the Buddha in sight? This is not the time. The Blessed One is tired. No one may approach." Ananda refused Subhadda yet again, but with their voices raised, the words reached the Buddha's ear, and he called out to Ananda, "Let him come. I know what he seeks. What I have to tell him, he will quickly understand." Subhadda paid homage to the Buddha and took a seat. "Lord, I would like to know, among all these monks and Brahmins, some of whom are even recognized as saints, if there are any who have achieved nirvana, and if one may receive direct transmission from them as they claim. Do not trouble yourself with this, Subhadda. I will teach you the Dhamma. Be still now and attend to my words." As the Buddha spoke, the lamp of Dhamma was lit for Subhadda and his doubts erased. He knew now with ultimate clarity that he had spent his life avoiding the very thing he sought, and it was as if by magic that the Buddha had turned the coin and showed Subhadda what his life could be through belief, extinguishing what it had become through disbelief, freeing him to seek enlightenment and become what he was born to be. And Subhadda is the last one to receive the teaching from the Buddha. In the morning, Gotama called his monks to his side for the last time. "It may be that some of you still have doubts about the Dhamma or concerns over the rules of the Sangha or questions about your path or the way of transmission. Speak now, so that afterwards you will not say, 'I was face to face with my teacher but could not speak.'" Buddha waited for a response, but the monks, with heads bowed, many with tears in their eyes, could not speak. "Do not be afraid. If you are in awe of me, then tell your friend and let him ask for you." With a silence still unbroken, Ananda said, "Lord, it is wonderful, it is a marvel. None speak because none have doubts about the Dhamma, the Sangha, or the path that leads to enlightenment." Buddha said, "You speak from the confidence of your faith, Ananda, but it is with direct knowledge that I can affirm your statement. Each of these monks has entered the stream and is destined for enlightenment." "Monks, all that appears must disappear. Whatever rises, dissolves. Work out your salvation with diligence." Siddhartha the Gautama, the Buddha, the Blessed One, having spoken his final words, in the heartbreak of silence left the world of appearances. And let me just read that last bit from the texts. So those are the last words of the Buddha that we have recorded. So this is from the Digha Nikaya, which describes the last year of the Buddha. This sutta describes the last year of the Buddha's life. "You, Ananda, speak out of confidence, but the Perfect One has knowledge that here in this Sangha of Bhikkhus, there is not one bhikkhu who has any doubt concerning the Buddha, or the Dhamma, or the Sangha, or the path, or the way of progress. The most backward of these 500 bhikkhus is a stream enterer, no more subject to perdition, certain of rightness, and destined to enlightenment. Then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, and this is the translation from the suttas that we have. Indeed, bhikkhus, I declare this to you, it is the nature of all formations to dissolve, attain perfection through diligence. A Wang. This was the perfect one's last utterance. And then it describes the way his consciousness changed to the final nirvana in this text. So, indeed, bhikkhus, I declare this to you, it is in the nature of all formations to dissolve, attain perfection through diligence. So, that's the life of the Buddha. It's a great story. I read it often, once or twice a year. Because we live in a world where the mundane is so important, even here. And mundane things are important, but there is this transcendent side of our spirit, of our consciousness, of our being, of whatever you call it. And that part of human consciousness gets lost in consumer society and political thought and economic thought and global warming and all these disasters which we're going to enter into tomorrow. So it can be a very kind of world of great fear and worry and concern and unemployment and so on and so forth. But it's probably always been that way. You know, has it really changed? There's always been difficulties and troubles and all the rest of it. So we have to deal with that. But is there an element? And I think this is very important if you're going to take on the Buddha's teaching. Is there an element in consciousness which you are missing? Is there something we're not seeing? And that's what the Buddha's saying. You know, there's something that you're missing if you don't understand what I have understood. And so the teachings on the Four Noble Truths and the different ways the teachings are given are a suggestion to us. But as the last lines say, it arises and ceases, it dissolves, you better get on with it. Work out your own practice with diligence. And perhaps that's one way to look at Vaisak, is both as a celebration of enlightenment itself, I think. You know, just that, you know, when I think of faith in Buddhism, it's not simply, you know, some historical character. It's the very faith that we as human beings have a dimension which is not just about success or acquisition. You know, we have a spiritual dimension to our a possibility of deep compassion and deep wisdom. And that for me seems to be when we take refuge in Buddha, that's one aspect of it. Not just as a kind of like a cultural artifact that we believe in or that, but that there is enlightenment. Now that sounds very far away. You know, I could never be enlightened because I'm still hung up on whatever I'm hung up on, right? But actually the awakened mind is always here. You know, we can know that we feel hot and sticky, I feel hot and sticky, that we want to be here or don't want to be here. We can know that. That whatever you're feeling right now, be it good, bad, or indifferent, you can know that. If you know that, you're enlightened to the way things are. If you don't know that and you're attaching to it, you're stuck. So at any moment we can awaken or we can fall asleep. And not just falling asleep physically, but be lost in ignorance. So wisdom is this beautiful capacity we have is to open and really know life as it presents itself and to trust in that. It's a kind of trusting thing. And if we trust in that and if we abide with that in a really diligent way, as we've been reading from Lompo Sumedho, it opens our consciousness to vast spaces of peace, vast possibilities of compassion, if we can just observe, if we can just be patient and not just get caught up with it. Various things of the world. So may this Vaisak give you the impetus to really question your own suffering and to really look deeply at it and say, well, why? What's the attachment? And then may the very troubles that you have lead you to the end of troubles. You know, may the very difficulties you have be the vehicle for the end of your difficulties, because that's the way it works. When you have troubles and difficulties, if you look at your own mind, they're the ones that enlighten you. They're the things that get you going. They're the ones that get you beyond those things. So may you have no difficulties, which is not human. So may you be healthy, may you be wealthy, may your kids never misbehave, may your grandkids never misbehave, you know, may your car never have a flat tire, may all your gardens have bounteous rainfall, may the deer not eat my plants, and so on and so forth. Okay, so you get 10% of that maybe, if you're lucky. But, deeper than that, beyond all that stuff, which we want, I want that, is there something which is even better than that? And that's peace. And that's the transcendent possibility of the human heart that sees life's changes, notices life's changes, and in the noticing of change, that is the secret of enlightenment. So rather than always being caught up in change, we become the Buddha knowing change. It's very simple, but very hard to do. So you, whatever you feel arises and ceases, if that is your perspective, if that's your focus, knowing anicca, being aware of anicca, then you're Buddha knowing Dharma. If you're caught up in the change, then you're in samsara and rebirth. Huh? So I hope a good rebirth for you, right? So that's also possible, I'm told, from the books. So if you want to do that, I think you're doing that already, actually. I think you're covered. I think you're okay. You're going to be all right. I can't guarantee it. I don't know what you're going to do tomorrow. But I think a good rebirth there is probably in the books. But is there something deeper and more profound? There is. And that's the peace of the heart, which is not dependent on conditions, which is not dependent on emotions, which is not dependent on kids and grandkids and the weather and your plants and the way people relate to you. It's the transcendent peace of knowing the way things are. And that we do by noticing change. That's simple. Just noticing how things change. So I'll leave that for your reflection tonight.